This is Functional Medicine Update for January 1999, Volume 18, Number 1. We begin the new year with an introduction to our theme for 1999. We call it the Year of Intercellular Communications. This month, we will be discussing the web-like nature of human function. We will review a number of recent studies related to this view of health management. On Side 2, our interview will be with Dr. Jeffrey Koppelson, discussing his work with autism. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the January 1999 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to January 1999 Functional Medicine Update. Yes, this is the year before the new millennium. And we're very excited about what 1999 and Functional Medicine Update will bring us, in that this is the year of intercellular communication. 1998 we might have characterized as the year of nutrient modulation of gene expression. It was the focus of our seminar series and our symposium held in May in Hawaii, the Institute for Functional Medicine, 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine. This year, however, in the extension of that theme, we're going to be focusing on modulation of intercellular communication and its relationship to the prevention and treatment of diseases throughout the ages, from childhood through adult and age-related diseases. A very exciting, evolving frontier in our understanding of the etiology of disease and opening up new opportunities for therapies that were previously unknown in the absence of that understanding. In fact, as you have often heard me quote, the answers to many of our questions may be lying in the file cards that are spilled on the floor. And all we need to do is arrange those file cards in the right way for extraordinary breakthroughs and understanding to occur. And hopefully this year we will take another step towards unshuffling those file cards and putting them into some kind of a logical order that will help all of us to better manage the challenges of a complex world with complex patients with complex symptoms and diseases. The theme that will emerge from this discussion, I believe, is a reinforcement of the concept of web. It is very interesting, isn't it, that most of us are taught by an analytical reductionistic model of thinking, true-false, right-wrong, yes-no, multiple-choice types of answers to questions that allow us to travel through our academic training with a high degree of proficiency and be rewarded for our skill if we can answer those black and white reductionistic questions. But yet when we move into the real world, we find it's a world of shades of gray, often confounded by the lack of blinded, controlled, simplistic studies in which decisions have to be made from less than perfect data. And quite honestly, as we have started to learn from chaos theory and pattern recognition and multivariate analysis, the reality of our world is a time-dependent, not static, equilibrium model of function, constantly in change, constantly in chaotic bursts of order and disorder, patterns of assembly and disassembly. And therefore, we recognize that the reality of physiology, of society, of social network, is the web. Interesting, isn't it, that this is also the age, in electronic parlance, of the World Wide Web, web thinking, web behavior, web function. And certainly we are seeing that in medicine as we better understand the interaction of organs, organ systems, tissues, and cells, and even supramolecular biomolecules. Web-like interactions, action at a distance, through web-like feedback processes, feed-forward and feedback. Well, that will be a theme for this year, and it will be seen in so many ways. Even as interesting as the now famous intratoxigenic E. coli 0157 disaster that resulted in the death to a number of children and disabling kidney disease and kidney failure in many others as a consequence of the consumption of foods that were contaminated with this bacterium. Where did this bacterium come from? Why did it suddenly appear? Was it we were just suddenly cooking our hamburgers at lower temperature And so the bacterium was living in our burgers where before it had been killed because we went from eating well-cooked meat to rare. I think the answer that most of us come up to is no, this was not the explanation as to why 0157 suddenly started to become an infectious disease concern in public health, but rather there was something else about the appearance of this mutant E. coli, a normal symbiote or at least commensal in the human gastrointestinal tract, now turned stealth invader, a lethal invader in some. Where did it come from? Well, looking at it as a linear reductionistic question, you know, we can go back through what's called the HACCP program in food production, which is the Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point approach to look at the place where the organism might have snuck into our food supply system and try to make sure by putting thermometers in our beef that's on griddles that they're cooked to a specific temperature to make sure that we have killed all the bugs. This is a little bit like the chemotherapy model for cancer. Make sure every cell is dead. Saturation bombing, so to speak. But maybe there's another explanation that we should be looking for as well, beyond just killing the bug when it exists, and that is, where did the bug come from? And how does it relate to web-like thinking in an ecological system, knowing that we live within the ecos, the home, in which we interact with that home? And then we are confronted with an article that appeared in Science Magazine, volume 281, page 1666 in 1998, entitled Grain Feeding and the Dissemination of Acid-Resistant E. coli from Cattle, which causes us to think very differently about where 0157 might have come from. This article points out that the gastric stomach of humans is a barrier to foodborne pathogens, but that E. coli can survive at a pH of 2, reasonably acidic, obviously, if it is grown under mildly acidic conditions. As you know, the E. coli presumably was passed from food to human through cattle. Cattle are a natural reservoir for pathogenic E. coli. And cattle fed mostly grain is known to have lower colonic pH and more acid-resistant E. coli by natural selection. But when the cattle were fed hay, which, by the way, most cattle in a natural ecological system forage on hay, not grain, not people food, but when they were fed hay, on the basis of numbers and survival after acid shock, these hay-fed cattle had a million-fold fewer acid-resistant E. coli than those that were fed grain. And in fact, even a brief period of hay feeding was found to decrease the acid-resistant count in cattle substantially. Well, what is the potential implication of that in our web-like thinking model? That somehow changing the ecology of the way that animals are raised has an impact on bacterial flora in the ruminant, which then influences the potential for mutational alteration in these bacteria, which then influences through the food supply system the transmission of those bacteria to humans and in individuals with compromised immunological systems or specific susceptibility factors. Those new mutant bacteria, 0157, adhere to receptor sites on a unique gastrointestinal mucosa of certain individuals to produce an extraordinary immunological response that jeopardizes the life of the individual, at least throws them into shock and serious renal failure. By thinking this through in a slightly different way, we come to maybe a different perspective as to how to manage these kinds of problems. It leads to ecological, web-like, or interactive models rather than let's kill the bug with irradiation of all food, with antibiotic treatments, by prophylaxis, by cooking things to temperatures that then cause the meat to be damaged because we've now well-cooked meat to the point where we're forming heterocyclic amine compounds within the food, which are known to be carcinogens, according to Dr. Michael Pariza and others. So now we trade off the risk of 0157 for the potential of long-term risk to carcinogen exposure. Very, very interesting way of thinking and a different approach than that of the linear reductionistic method of thinking and problem solving that many of us were trained. Well, that leads us then to ask the question, what about how we understand and care for the distressed patient who has multiple medically unexplained symptoms, who doesn't fall conveniently into a nice ICD-9 code or whose medical taxonomic definition is not so tidy that we know exactly what's wrong with them? Do we just manage their symptoms by individual application of the medical pharmacopoeia, so an analgesic, an antacid, an antidepressant, whatever is required, or do we try to look for interacting themes that give rise to an understanding of the expression of dysfunction, which then we can monitor or measure or then even modulate at the causative level. This is actually the very interesting theme of a paper recently published in the Journal of the American Board of Family Practice in Volume 11, page 347, 1998, in which the article goes on to say that although physicians are commonly encountering patients with complicated medical problems, they have a mix of unexplained medical symptoms and distress that can seem overwhelming to both the physician and the patient. And what needs to be developed is a model of thinking about and helping these complex patients that moves out of the simple-minded diagnostic code system in which you're looking for the disease that results with these symptoms. These authors, Dr. Edward Walker, Jürgen Unstner, and Wayne Canton, have all been talking about how this model of predisposing factors, perpetuating factors, and precipitating factors give rise to a different way of approaching the patient. Now, this sounds very reminiscent of the model that we have been talking about for nearly 8 years, developed by Dr. Leo Gallen, the patient-centered assessment model of antecedents, triggers, mediators, signs, and symptoms, as a way of evaluating complex etiologies to give rise to understanding of mechanisms, not just diseases. Antecedents, triggers, mediators, resulting in signs and symptoms. The mediators are what we're going to be speaking to great extent this year, 1999, in Functional Medicine Update, because they relate to the intracellular signals that tell cells at a distance what might be going on somewhere else to jump into alarm or to jump into a new state of physiological function, to express genes in a different way that move from the normalcy of a resilient physiology to the activity of a physiology that may downstream produce pathology that later then becomes an ICD-9 code. In this article by Walker, Unstner, and Caton, they talk about awareness of the factors, antecedents, triggers, mediators, signs, and symptoms, allow the clinician not only to tolerate and gradually unravel the complicated interactions that create and sustain distress in patients with multiple medically unexplained symptoms, but also devise practical and effective management strategies for these complex patients. What an aha when we start thinking about Webb rather than just differential diagnosis. So we're talking about function, and of course that leads us to a very interesting paper that recently appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled Importance of Functional Measures in Predicting Mortality Among Older Hospitalized Patients. In this paper they describe that functional measures are strong predictors of morbidity and mortality in older age patients at the 2-year level after hospitalization, and that if we can improve function more than just change laboratory signs, that we have a much better prognosis for the patient with lower utilization of medical services and extension of their health span and possibly their lifespan. Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 279, page 1187 in 1998, discussed functional measures in predicting mortality and reduced morbidity in hospital patients. Well, this is a very interesting emergence of a new model. Looking at webs, looking at antecedents, triggers, mediators, signs and symptoms, tying that to function, then relating that to diagnostic codes, but not being hidebound by a single vision of diagnostic codes. When you start looking at medicine and health and disease from this particular perspective, it opens up a lot of new opportunities. For instance, recently a paper was published, acute renal failure in alcoholic patients taking therapeutic doses of acetaminophen, in which they confirmed in this paper what had been reported in the New England Journal of Medicine some year earlier that we actually reviewed in Functional Medicine Update, a report that some individuals who were taking the suggested dose of acetaminophen from the label suggestions may run the risk to acute renal and hepatic failure. It's not just liver dysfunction, it's also kidney dysfunction that can result from this as a consequence of their unique metabolism of acetaminophen or paracetamol, producing NAPQI, a toxic liver and kidney metabolite that depletes glutathione reserves and increases the risk of exposure to the liver and kidney to oxidative stress and tissue death, apoptotic cell death. And so when you start looking at unique biochemistries, individual susceptibilities, and put that in the context of family histories, it starts leading us towards the concept of personalized medicine, a theme that will advance as we move into the new millennium and become the watchword, I think, of a more tailored, effective, and cost-efficient form of healthcare, personalized medicine. And as you know, the difference from one individual to another in the way they metabolize acetaminophen or any other substance or xenobiotic agent has to do with their unique genetic difference in their detoxification enzyme systems and their receptor sites to the message of toxins. Again, a very interesting paper was published in the American Family Physician Journal, volume 57, page 107 in 1998, talking about the genetic polymorphisms of the cytochrome P450 detoxification systems and how this relates to different drug sensitivities and potential reactivities, depending on whether a person has a genetic weakness in cytochrome P450-3A2, which has to do with metabolism of amitriptyline or benzodiazepines like Xanax or Halcyon or calcium blocker drugs, in which these individuals may be much more susceptible to adverse effects from those drugs because of altered detoxification, or individuals that have altered cytochrome P450-2E1, which is where acetaminophen plays a role, or ethanol in conjunction with acetaminophen. Many people can drink ethanol, take acetaminophen concomitantly with no potential risk. But those who have a genetic weakness of cytochrome P450-2E1, or let's say uniqueness, may be at much higher risk to renal and hepatic damage as a consequence of concomitant consumption of acetaminophen and ethanol drinking alcohol. What about cytochrome P450-2D6 and its potential genetic uniqueness and how that interrelates with Prozac and individuals who are on these SSRI drugs? And which of these are inducible that have direct impact on diet and lifestyle and nutrition that can influence their function? So it's not just the genes, but it's also their induction from the genes that relates to their function. These are questions that are just now starting to frame a new medicine, a personalized medicine, one built around pharmacogenetics, the interrelationship between the genetic uniqueness of the individual and how they metabolize certain materials and ultimately convert them into, in the case of toxins, detoxified materials that they can excrete or substances that are better used downstream in secondary metabolic pathways. Obviously, what I'm speaking to is an extension of what Dr. Roger Williams talked about with biochemical individuality in the 1950s, that which Dr. Linus Pauling talked about as molecular medicine in his landmark article, Sickle Cell Anemia, a Molecular Disease, in 1949. We're now just starting to witness the emergence of a medicine based upon these principles in 1999. And we are going to see the Human Genome Project opening up for us an understanding of how this is applied by new diagnostic tests that will be simply able to evaluate genetic uniqueness at the gene level. And which of these characteristics are modifiable by expression differences through nutrition and lifestyle? And how will that influence then the reduction of risk to certain diseases that range from heart disease to cancer to diabetes to arthritis to various autoimmune disorders that occur in later life? A very powerful new medical paradigm that is emerging that one cannot hold back because of the increasing weight of evidence from basic science. Let me give you an illustration of this. New England Journal of Medicine, an interesting paper that might appear a little esoteric, but certainly relates to this emerging theme. High risk of cerebral vein thromboses in carriers of a prothrombin gene mutation and in users of oral contraceptives. Well, what does this all say? Well, the editorial carries a message very nicely that follows this paper that appeared in volume 338, page 1793, in 1998 issue of the New England Journal. It's entitled, Venous Thrombosis, the Interaction of Genes and Environment. It's been said in this editorial that here is a classic example of some women who are taking oral contraceptive drugs who carry with them a specific gene uniqueness. They carry a prothrombin gene mutation that makes them much more susceptible to clotting problems as a consequence of the consumption or use of oral contraceptives, and they then run the risk of cerebral vein thromboses. In much of the research that has been done in medicine over the past 50 years, it was the research of averages, the law of averages, the Gaussian curve of statistical variation, symmetrical about the midpoint, maybe slightly non-parametric, shifted to the upper end, but normally parametric statistics were used, standard deviations from the mean, and from that, statistical significance was ascribed based upon the data. Unfortunately, what we're learning is that there are cohorts within these Gaussian curves that have unique susceptibilities that were lost in the noise of the data, lost in the law of averages. And if we went back and reevaluated the data from all the published studies, much of which said that certain things were not true, we would find, lo and behold, they were true if we looked at sub-cohorts or certain groups within the whole who did respond and responded or had risk of high prevalence. This is like the women who smoke who go on to get breast cancer who have poor acetylator status. And there is a much higher risk for those women when they smoke to breast cancer than women at large who don't carry the poor acetylator status gene. And yet in the studies that had been published in the Journal of the Medical World before this observation, it was said there was no real relationship between smoking and breast cancer in women because these subtypes were washed out in the law of the averages. A very interesting application of the principle of personalized medicine, the right thing for the right individual. And fortunately, as a consequence of new diagnostic tests available in the clinical laboratory, we will be able to answer these questions much better about who has what uniqueness so that those therapies can be personalized. And so in the future, giving a drug to which a person is responding adversely that produces an adverse side effect may make the physician legally liable for that adverse side effect if they did not at first ask the question, how does that person metabolize those medications? Are they susceptible? Are they an individual whose detox systems cannot effectively manage that particular medication? A very interesting different burden of proof on how things are done when we start talking about personalization of medicine. So an evidence-based medical approach is certainly starting to come about based upon this antecedents, trigger, mediator, signs and symptoms model, the web-like approach, and how that interrelates then to personalization of medicine. I was very intrigued by the JAMA in their volume 280, page 1264, an article entitled An Evidence-Based Approach to Interactive Communication of Health Issues, in which the authors are talking about the fact that thanks to the World Wide Web and electronic information exchange and the exploding information around how individuals respond to their environment, that this communication of concepts, which will then be delivered to individuals, should be based upon an evidence, empirical observation, not just theory, but how did it actually work? What were the results? Not always tied so tightly to some kind of a logical, linear, analytical information gathering and decision-making tree, but rather to a web-like decision-making tree, looking at the strength of evidence from clinical experience, animal studies, epidemiological work, clinical case management studies, and coming to a decision around risk and benefit. And then from that, making a decision to move ahead. A good example of this is homocysteine. As you have recalled from the Kilmer-McCulley extraordinary discovery some 39 years ago, it's now worked its way into medicine that homocysteine in marginal elevations in plasma does serve as a risk factor to various vascular disorders and even dementia-related disorders now in more recent literature as it relates to Alzheimer's. And in a very interesting paper recently published under the title Stepped Care, an Evidence-Based Approach to Drug Therapy, Abby Harris and Harris have described how one can develop an evidence-based decision-making tree for things like the homocysteine relationship to cardiovascular disease. And they call it the STEP, S-T-E-P, which stands for safety. How safe is the particular therapy that's suggestion? That's the S. The T is tolerability. What are the dropout rates from clinical trials? Will people tolerate the therapy? The next is E in the STEP, effectiveness. How well the drug or the therapy works in what patient population? So we have safety, tolerability, and effectiveness. And then lastly is P, the price. How accessible is the price to individuals on that particular therapy? So STEP, safety, tolerability, effectiveness, and price, gives rise to an evidence-based assessment as to the applicability of that approach. Well, when one applies the STEP concept to the homocysteine theory of cardiovascular disease, as is pointed out in this article, you are quickly able to see its merit. Because, first of all, it's very safe, because we're talking about B6, B12, and folate supplementation, which at the doses required have little to non-existent adverse side effects. Tolerability, people can take a supplement a day with no problem, and it's very well complied with, or you can fortify foods with these nutrients so that it's gotten in the diet. Effectiveness, the data now is quite convincing that it is effective, and the price is pennies per day. So in the case of homocysteine, which was resisted by medicine as a concept for 39 years, it fulfills all the criteria of an evidence-based medicine effective approach towards the reduction of risk of a major killer disease, cardiovascular disease. So a new decision-making tree results in a different outcome decision than that which we have been kind of constipated through our blinded placebo-controlled trial mentality, which is very good for drugs, but not so good for multifactorial contributions to complex illnesses. And using the STEP approach, we might be led to making decisions in a different way. Certainly as an example, in the case of homocysteine and its relationship to vascular disease, that is the case. Again, for those of you that might want to know this particular journal, this appeared in Evidence-Based Medicine Approach in December of 1998. What about then the role of B12, folate, and B6 and other conditions other than just that of homocysteine and vascular risk? Well, we've been talking in Functional Medicine Update, and actually back into the earlier years of Preventive Medicine Update, its precedent, about the role of vitamin B12 and folate in cognitive function in older age individuals, and that this supposed placebo effect where people were getting intramuscular B12 shots in older age, and they were saying, I feel so much better, yet their serum B12 was normal before they got the test and normal after they got supplementation, it was said, well, this was all placebo, that they clearly did not have any evidence of B12 deficiency. But yet more and more from the work of Dr. John Lindemann at Columbia University Department of Neurology and many other investigators, are we starting to see the B12 connection with cognitive function, particularly in older age individuals, become a significant issue, even in the face of normal serum vitamin levels. I'm now quoting from Dr. Lindemann's studies. Another paper that follows the same theme and certainly fulfills the criteria of support from an evidence-based medicine perspective is a paper published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, volume 46, page 1199 in 1998, entitled The Effect of Vitamin B12 Insufficiency on Older Veterans and Its Relationship to Health, in which they showed that there were a very much higher level of vitamin B12 insufficiency than had been previously thought in looking at older individuals on the basis of functional improvement when they were administered vitamin B12. You couldn't measure this just by a positive Schilling's or the absence of a positive Schilling's or by a low serum vitamin B12 level. You had to look at more functional measures of vitamin B12, like homocysteine levels in the urine or methylmalonic acid excretion levels or plasma methylmalonic acid. These would be much more reflective of functional insufficiencies of B12 and correlated very closely with cognitive function in older age individuals. Another confirmation of this theme that we've been describing for some time in Functional Medicine Update. So that leads us then to the concept of how we modulate these intercellular communication agents, the cell modulators and mediators of signs and symptoms, altered cell physiology, the pain, fatigue, dystonia that occurs when the physiology has been shifted to a new point of equilibrium. And that will be the focus of our 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine to be held May 23rd to 26th, 1999, in Tucson, Arizona. This is the first call for those of you making your plans for the spring. I greatly encourage you to put that week on your schedule and be in attendance at our 6th International Symposium, which is entitled Disorders of Mediators and Messengers, Their Relationship to Functional Illness. I think we're going to have an extraordinary conference this year. Dr. Candace Pert and Dr. Michael Ruff will be speaking about their pioneering work in the discovery of binding sites for neurotransmitters on the surface of white cells that gives the birth to the mechanistic understanding of the mind-body connection. That will then be followed up by a very excellent presentation by Dr. Russell Ryder, professor of medicine at the University of Texas, in which he'll be talking about how melatonin serves as a seminal molecule in cell signaling and how it can be used as a kind of a specific example of a more general theme related to modifications of intercellular communication and mediators and how that relates to signs and symptoms of various disorders. We will then move on the second day to our keynote presentations, focusing on modulation of oncogenes and cytokine expression, with a presentation by Dr. Vincent Castronovo, former National Cancer Society, National Institutes of Health investigator, now head of the Metastasis Research Unit at University of Liège in Belgium, who will be speaking about modification and nutrient modulation of oncogenes. That'll be followed up by a presentation by Dr. Johanna Lampe from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington, in which she'll be talking about her work on soy isoflavones and their modulation of intercellular communication and effect on health and disease. And Dr. George Zabrecki, a combination medical doctor and chiropractor, will be talking about zinc fingers and their relationship to cellular oncogenesis and how diet and lifestyle influence those phylogenetic effects. Then on day three, we'll be looking at messengers and stress-related illnesses. And I'm very pleased that Dr. Robert Sapolsky from Stanford University School of Medicine, the author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, and one of the investigators that has been given the greatest credit for developments in the understanding of stress-related illnesses at the mechanistic level. He'll be talking to us about stress modulators and messengers and their mediation through lifestyle and diet. Dr. Robert Learman, an expert in the area of fatty acid biochemistry and cardiovascular disease and metabolic obesity, will be speaking to us about intercellular communication through essential fatty acids and their relationship to chronic degenerative disease. And then we're going to get an update from Dr. Kilmer McCulley, the past recipient of the Linus Pauling Award, who will be coming back to give us an update on homocysteine and help us then to award the 1999 Linus Pauling Award. And each afternoon we'll have workshops from some extraordinary clinicians that will be taking us through the clinical applications of these concepts that will be described in the 3 days of disorders of mediators and messengers and their relationship to functional illness. So please put on your schedule the May 23rd through 26, 1999, 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine. You will obviously be receiving a brochure on this with a full program and confirmation of the accreditation for postgraduate continuing medical education and all the other workshops that will be going on. We'll have a basic nutrition workshop for those of you that might want to tune up your nutrition skills, and we'll be having a workshop on the primers of functional medicine. So I hope to see you there in late May. This is the first call. You'll be hearing about this more in Functional Medicine Update in further months. Let me move now into the concept of intercellular communication and describe some of the things that we all know, but maybe in a slightly different context, in a context that hopefully helps in developing your web when you see that patient and are starting to analyze complex symptoms and wondering how to fit them into a treatment program. The first relates to steroid hormones. Cortisol, testosterone, estrogens, DHEA, pregnenolone. How do we think of these? What are these molecules? How do they influence function? How are they modified in their levels and activity? In asking those questions, we are sent on a path of discovery that I believe is never-ending, because we'll probably never be able to answer all of those questions completely. So there's always something more to know, something more to learn. What we have learned, however, is that these molecules, which are derived from cholesterol through a series of extraordinary metabolic transformations that occur in various tissues like the adrenal glands or the ovaries or the testes, go on to elaborate various signaling molecules whose structural function activities can remarkably vary by just simple changes in the molecular personality of these molecules. So we have a steroid molecule nucleus, what is called a tetracyclic triterpenoid nucleus, and then we put a hydroxyl group at a certain position on the A ring or the C ring, and it changes its activity. And we isomerize that from a beta position to an alpha position, and we get a different activity. And we add a methyl group here, we subtract a methyl group there, and we get a different activity. What I'm saying is that the body, in terms of these mediators, has exquisite selectivity and sensitivity. And very small shape changes in molecules can make extraordinary changes in the way they fit onto receptor sites and influence function. So that something that at one time was producing male-like symptoms, I'm using the stereotypical connotation of male-like, can then, by slight modification in the form of a testosterone dehydrogenation or a desaturation, result in female-like characteristics. Just by taking a few hydrogen atoms off of the A ring of the tetracyclic triterpenoid molecule, converts a testosterone to an estrogen. The effects are quite obvious. The structural changes are very small. So I want you to recall that these mediators of function are very carefully controlled. And if we get in there and start playing around with these mediators by throwing in a chemical soup of new agents, exogenous agents, like hormone replacement therapy or xenoestrogens that come from the environment, we can really jam the communication system of our body, producing a wide variety of symptoms, because it's not just a single organ that these molecules interact with. These receptor sites for these hormones appear on the surfaces of cells as far-ranging as the heart or the brain, or the liver, or the muscles, not just the target tissues of the reproductive glands. And we have aldosterone, and we have cortisol, and we have DHEA, and we have a myriad, actually hundreds of different steroid-related molecules that can influence function. I bring that up because we're now recognizing these feedback pathways work in webs, again, that women whose estrogen starts to diminish have not just changes in reproductive patterns, but they have changes in the skin texture, in their immune defense, their cognitive function, i.e. memory, their blood coagulation parameters, their lipid profiles. Lots of things change as a consequence of modification of these signaling molecules. So when we look at dysfunction, dysfunction really occurs by alteration of mediator molecules that then produce wide-ranging symptoms in distant organ systems, for which then the challenge to the diagnostician, clinician, is start assembling patterns of understanding, clusters of understanding. So the steroid molecules, as described in the Annual Review of Physiology, Volume 59, page 365, is an extraordinary family to understand. And by the way, I should mention that if you look at the structure of steroid molecules, the hormones, there's a vitamin family that has a very close similarity in its structure, and this is the vitamin D family. Cholecalciferol, vitamin D. You know, we make it from our skin, don't we? Because the sunlight somehow activates a process to convert provitamin D into vitamin D. That's why people that don't get outside at all have vitamin D insufficiency, because their steroid hormone molecules are converted into vitamin D molecules by light of a particular wavelength exposure. Well, this is important because the functions of vitamin D also mimic in part that of the steroid hormones. Vitamin D is not just a calcium hormone that through cholecalciferol and then its hydroxylation into 1,25-dihydroxycholecalciferol as a consequence of liver and kidney hydroxylation produces this hormone. It doesn't just influence only calcium binding protein expression in the gastrointestinal mucosa, which then allows for calcium to be better taken up from the gut into the blood, but it also has an effect on the immune system. It has effect on cognitive function. It is a more broad activity than just a single activity of calcium. So think of vitamin D insufficiency almost as a consequence or interrelated with the whole nature of the steroid molecules. It's interesting to note if you drove cholesterol levels down very low by cholesterol-lowering therapy, and that person didn't get outside like many older age individuals do not, you might then produce a insufficiency in vitamin D, which could have immunological consequences that would be adverse. So again, web-like thinking, not just single-activity thinking. One of the other things that we learned about cell signaling in our studies of intermediary clinical biochemistry was that not just steroid hormones play a role in signaling messages from cells to cells and tissues to tissues, but also small molecules like cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP signaling and its relationship to gene expression is extraordinarily interesting and, as you know, is one of the principal first signal messengers. Cyclic adenosine monophosphate, cyclic AMP, is a ubiquitous molecule. We actually call it a second signal messenger. It gets its trigger from first signal messengers that we'll describe in a moment. And it's produced in cells in response to hormones and nutrients, and therefore steroid hormones may interact with receptor sites on cells to then interact with the machinery that converts ATP into cyclic AMP. There are nutrients that also do this and can trigger this response. We also know that various pro-inflammatory agents like histamine can have this effect as well. The production of cyclic AMP is dependent upon the actions of many different proteins that affect its synthesis and degradation. An important function of cyclic AMP is to activate the phosphorylating enzyme protein kinase A, which converts various enzymes from inactive forms to active forms by phosphorylation. The key roles of cyclic AMP and protein kinase A in the phosphorylation and regulation of enzyme substrates involved in intermediary metabolism now are well studied and part of all of our education. A newly discovered role, however, for protein kinase A is the phosphorylation and activation of transcriptional factors that are critical for the control of gene expression in response to elevated levels of cyclic AMP. So in situations of allergy or alarm where cyclic AMP is increased in its level, there is a turn on of transcription, an upregulation of transcription of certain genes, which modifies then the way that our cells are functioning through modification of gene expression. So I think this is a very interesting newly emergent theme that we have been describing that is the mechanism by which environment and genes interact to give rise to phenotype of function, that the cell signaling molecules like cyclic AMP, not only cyclic AMP, but like cyclic AMP, can then influence functional alteration in gene expression across many cell types. And cyclic AMP is increased in levels as a consequence of the interaction of the cell with its environment. We know that cytoplasmic ATP-dependent regulation of ion transport and channels is also interrelated to cyclic AMP. So the uptake of magnesium and potassium across cell membranes and the export of calcium and sodium to the exterior of the cell through these calcium channel ports or potassium-sodium ports are driven by ATP and are interrelated with cyclic AMP. Also cyclic GMP, and the balance between cyclic GMP and AMP plays an important role in the yin-yang tension across these dynamics that give rise to cellular equilibrium. We will learn in a moment that cyclic GMP interrelates with nitric oxide production, which is another signal messenger. And so we get a web of intercellular mediators that are creating different physiological states as a consequence of an individual being exposed to a precipitating trigger, a trigger that works on their antecedents, which is their biological genotype. This is a new model, isn't it, of how dysfunction might emerge. By the way, this interesting study and review of how cytoplasmic ATP-dependent regulation of ion transport channels works, its mechanisms, and its messengers, you'll find in the Annual Review of Physiology, Volume 59, page 193. Another regulator of this process is cellular reduction oxidation. This is a new, very interesting part of the story as to what creates messages within cells that regulate their function and gene expression, redox potential. And where does redox really participate in the cell? Its activity comes through the mitochondrion, the cellular powerhouse. And redox regulation of cellular activation is an emerging view as to how certain genes are turned on and turned off. So now we have cyclic AMP, cyclic GMP, steroid hormone activation, and their interrelationships with redox potential across the mitochondrion. Growing evidence has indicated that cellular reduction oxidation status regulates various aspects of cellular function. As you know, oxidative stress is a term that has been applied by Helmut Sies, S-I-E-S, to define a state of intercellular redox that shifted towards the oxidation side. And it elicits positive responses such as cellular proliferation or activation, as well as negative responses such as growth inhibition or cell death by what is called apoptotic cell death, as contrasted to necrotic cell death. Cellular redox status is maintained by intracellular redox regulating molecules. These include things like thioredoxin. It's a small protein that has redox disulfide dithiol within the conserved active site sequences and interrelates in its function and structure to the activity of glutathione in its reduced state and lipoic acid, dihydrolipoate. And therefore, the conversion of activity of redox is dependent upon the antioxidant levels and forms of these active sulfhydryl-containing materials like glutathione. Is it oxidized or reduced? And lipoic acid, is it oxidized or reduced? We know that when there is an upregulation of the immune system and a release of cell messengers like interleukins, particularly interleukin-2, and tumor necrosis factor alpha, that there is a shift in cellular physiology towards the oxidative state in the redox potential. and you start to see an expression of different gene transcription factors, like those associated with oxidation, such as NF-kappa-B, nuclear factor kappa-B. These are signs of increased response to what the cell is defining as a hostile environment, if I can use that term advisedly. And therefore, oxidative chemistry shifted in that direction of redox potential may be considered that which is associated with lowered resiliency and increased cellular death, biological aging. Now, there are times where this shift is very important in the case of infection or trauma or specific mechanical injury to cells, where recycling of cellular materials is necessary, or where a cell has undergone a functional mutational injury and needs to be put to death, so to speak, so that it will not elicit its message to other cells. But if it occurs in an accelerated way over long periods of time, this increased apoptotic cell death can result in premature cellular loss of function, which we associate with biological aging and age-related diseases. And so redox regulation of cellular function and gene expression is now emerging to be another important tool that will help us to better understand the web of dysfunction. And by the way, we can do this by different assessment tools for redox or oxidative stress in the laboratory. That concludes Side 1 of this month's Functional Medicine Update. Let's turn to Side 2 and now discuss how some of these intercellular signals relate to a specific condition, and that is childhood autism. As you know, this month in Functional Medicine Update, we're focusing our whole issue on intercellular communication and the aspects of it that relate to the emerging view of the etiology of various chronic degenerative and age-related diseases. One of the most exciting areas that we are seeing some extraordinary application of this concept is actually not in an older age or middle age related dysfunction, but in a condition that's seen most often in children, and that's autism. And we're very pleased to have today a clinician who will bring to us, I think, a perspective that is one of those revolutions in thinking. Dr. Jeffrey Koppelson is our clinician of the month, who will be speaking to us about this new relationship between secretin and autism and its potential use in treatment of autism. Dr. Koppelson comes with an MD degree from New York Medical College and a background in biological sciences from Syracuse University, and having been in practice in both family practice and nutritional medicine since 1993 to the present, has really started to integrate many of the concepts that we in Functional Medicine Update and previous Preventive Medicine Update have been discussing for many years. Dr. Koppelson, I think one of the first questions that I've always asked individuals is what intrigued them about the area of nutritional medicine or these integrative therapies and move them from where they might have been previous from their training into this new area. I'd like to start with that question and welcome you to Functional Medicine Update.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. I'm very happy to be here and I feel privileged to be here. Actually, when people ask me that question, I relate what I think is a very funny story, but it was very important to me. And that is about 8 years ago, I had a dog that was very sick, and we brought our dog to a holistic vet, who then began to prescribe vitamins and antioxidants, and lo and behold, several months later, the dog was healthy and happy again, and quite honestly, that impressed me quite a bit. And I started taking these vitamins and antioxidants myself and found that I felt better and had more energy, and that's really what stimulated me to move in this direction.
Well, I think it's extraordinary that people have these aha experiences in their life by their own personal observations. If it hits the right personality type, a person who is a seeker and is open-minded to new observations, it can send them in a path that can embellish their past training and give them new opportunities. Certainly, that seems to be a characteristic shared by almost all of the clinicians of the month that we've had the fortune to have on Functional Medicine Update. Let me, if I can, move to this secretin area, which I think is, or secretin, which is a very interesting new advance. Was excited to see that even on the MSNBC webpage recently, it shows that it's kind of hit the high-level marquee under the title, Could New Therapy Cure Autism? In which they talk about the use of this gut-brain neurohormone to modify autism, which certainly suggests that there is something about the gut-brain connection in children who express this situation that is of importance for us to understand. Could you tell us first a little bit about the history of secretin in autism, and then maybe we can move from that to a discussion about how the gut and the brain are interrelated.
Well, Jeff, secretin has actually a fairly interesting history. It's been around for some time, and it's been used by gastroenterologists for decades to test for pancreatic dysfunction. As happens with many of these discoveries, it was completely serendipitous, actually. An autistic child was getting examined, was getting endoscoped by a gastroenterologist, and as part of the procedure, received an intravenous injection of secretin. And mom noticed in the next several weeks and the following months that the child made amazing progress in developing his social skills. It was actually rather remarkable, and we were very fortunate because this mom happens to have an incredible knack for doing research and making associations, and she came to the conclusion that, in fact, it was the secretin that the child received that caused the advance in the child's ability to interact with his environment. We were very fortunate for that to happen, and I was fortunate to hear about this fairly early on, about a year ago, being that I thought that secretin was a non-toxic substance that had tremendous potential in helping these children. I felt obligated to try it and hope for good results.
Well, I'm very interested to watch how quickly this concept, this discovery, has moved into the general understanding and review. It demonstrates the power of the web-like society that we're living in now, in which information that has a value travels at light speed now. It's not held in a cloistered environment like it used to be, waiting for peer review and the slow plodding progress from one individual to another. We really see an explosive exchange of information. And as an extent to demonstrate that, I was very intrigued to see the November 16th, 1998, web message that was put out by the National Institutes of Health, in which Ms. Marie Bristol, who is the health scientist administrator for NIH Child Health and Human Development, asked for a secretin registry so that children who are on this could be monitored, and that it's now under a compassionate use status. So clearly, this must have gotten on the radar screen. Do you see more and more individuals starting to use it with autistic children?
Yes, as a matter of fact, Jeff. There has been pretty much an explosion of use in this country with the presentation of the Dateline segment about a month ago, which illustrated how effective secretin can be. That involved the mom that I mentioned previously and her son, and it documented this very nicely. And since that time, the use of secretin has really exploded.
Well, that leads us then to the question of how a hormone or a neurotransmitter that had been used diagnostically for evaluating aspects of pancreatic function could in fact have an impact upon brain chemistry and behavior. So it seems to almost speak in contradiction to the compartmentalization model of the body that many of us learned in our anatomy and physiology. Could you tell us a little bit about the suggested mechanism of how a gut hormone is related potentially to a brain chemical function?
Well, Jeff, some of the most wonderful things that I've experienced in treating these autistic children is having my mind opened up to this very thing, that everything in our body is related. And I know that in past segments that you've recorded, you've mentioned this any number of times, particularly in one of the segments two or three months ago. And in fact, the gut and the brain are very intimately connected. I believe that the children that become autistic become so because they develop a certain type of immune dysfunction, and that in fact autism is really an environmental illness. I believe that children are born with a genetic predisposition to developing immune dysfunction, and that what happens after they're born, sometimes purely by chance, when they get a vaccine or how many times they're being treated with antibiotics, has everything to do with creating the immune dysfunction, which then spills over into the central nervous system. What I believe happens is that there's a chronic inflammation of the intestinal tract begins to occur, which leads to intestinal leakage, which then leads to immune dysfunction, which, if it gets sufficiently severe, leads to the central nervous dysfunction that we tend to place in the autistic spectrum. Now, as far as secretin is concerned, secretin has been used in many ways in the past. In fact, in the 80s, it was used in Germany for gastrointestinal bleeding. I believe that secretin is primarily a gut healer, and that's probably why it works in autism. By healing the gut, we are healing the immune system and therefore healing the central nervous system. I know that sounds rather simplistic, but I can't really do very much better than that at this point without further research. Secretin probably also directly affects the central nervous system.
I was very intrigued to see how the model that you just described ties itself together so nicely with the work that Dr. William Shaw, Bill Shaw, published in Clinical Chemistry some 2 or 3 years ago. And actually, he was a researcher on Preventive Medicine Update, I think, 3 years ago, describing his work on autistic children and showing unique urinary metabolite patterns that reflected gut dysbiosis. It appears as if there's a connection then between the Shaw work and the secretin work.
Well, actually, dysbiosis has a great deal to do with the production of this syndrome. He will be one of the first to tell you, naturally, that the toxic bacteria and yeast that tend to grow in these children's GI tracts not only cause more chronic inflammation of the gut, but they also release toxic substances that affect the way we think and feel. Another issue that develops with autistic children is that as the immune dysfunction progresses, not only do they develop food allergies, but they also begin to process proteins differently from the way we normally do. Every time they eat a food that they're allergic to, usually these foods contain gluten and casein, every time they eat one of these foods, they cause further damage to the intestinal lining. Additionally, instead of breaking down these proteins into their component amino acids, what they do is break them down into peptides, which, number one, have opiate activity, and number two, are very toxic to the brain. In fact, one of the substances they produce in their guts, this is really an incredible thing, that they produce in their guts after consumption of these foods is actually the same toxin that natives in South America get from the poison dart frog. So the types and amounts of toxins they're producing in their gastrointestinal tracts is really an amazing and fascinating thing. Johnson & Johnson today is doing a tremendous amount of research into this, and they've identified these specific substances. It's fascinating.
Could you tell us a little bit about the DAN organization? I know that Dr. Bernard Rimlin and Dr. Sidney Baker and William Shaw and yourself and many others have been, Dr. Woody McGinnis, have been involved with this. For our listeners, it might be interesting for them to know a little bit about it.
When people refer to the DAN organization, by the way, that's Defeat Autism Now, that's what DAN stands for, usually they're referring to the DAN protocol. Now, the DAN protocol is actually not a protocol. It's merely a list of various tests that a group of people got together and recommended that they felt were useful for autistic children. Bernie Rimlin has, as well as the other individuals you've mentioned, they all have worked tirelessly to further the cause of the treatment of autism. I know that Bernie has been doing this for at least 2 decades, and Sid Baker and the others you've mentioned have worked with autistic children for varying amounts of time, and they need to be given a tremendous amount of credit in making autism more of a public issue, to lifting people's awareness of autism, and leading us to see the connection between autism and the rest of the body, the immune system and the gut. So the DAN organization is a group of concerned parents and physicians who try to work together to further the cause of the treatment of autism.
Recently, on the web, I saw a report by Dr. Sidney Schneider, who is a medical doctor but also a parent of an autistic child, who was describing what she thought was an adverse reaction to secretin in her child that she thought might have been a result of the fact that she was using or had experience with porcine secretin as contrasted to the synthetic secretin. Can you tell us a little bit about the potential for adverse side effects and whether there's a difference between the porcine and the synthetic?
There's a number of differences between the porcine and the synthetic secretin. Synthetic secretin is not commercially available in this country at this time. Human secretin and porcine secretin differ by 4 amino acids, so it's a slightly different chemical chain. Not only that, but porcine secretin is actually derived from the intestines of thousands and thousands of pigs, so that the potential for impurities is certainly there, although it's my understanding that the people that make this do a really very good job in purifying it. However, I would think, based on my experience with secretin thus far, that using the human version, because it's identical to our version naturally, and because it would be chemically pure, would be the ideal thing to do. As far as adverse effects from secretin, I really couldn't say if the adverse effects we see are due to the fact that it's a porcine-derived variety, or whether we're seeing adverse effects as a result of the secretin molecule. I would say that 60 to 70% of the patients I treat with secretin have experienced a beneficial effect as a result of using it. There are certainly children who experience no effect at all. About 5 to 7% of the children I've treated have had a temporary regression, which has been described as hyperactivity and some aggression as well. That's always been temporary. Being that this is an experimental technique at this time, we certainly can't be sure that no one will regress permanently. I don't believe that that's happened to anybody as yet. Other potential side effects are really the side effects that people experience with any medication. You have to be concerned about allergic reaction, that kind of thing.
Could you tell us what the general dose is in a child and its route of administration?
The route of administration that I've been using and those who have been doing this have been using is an intravenous route. As far as dose is concerned, most people have been using one vial in almost all of the children, as far as I understand. Ferring, the producer of the product, recommends a certain amount per kilogram. However, I must say that I don't really believe that this is a dose-related effect. When we think in terms of doses and the use of medications, typically we're talking about drugs that suppress symptoms that require a specific serum level to work. I believe that what secretin is doing actually is setting up a chain reaction, and that the exact dose is really not so terribly significant. Keep in mind that in one vial of secretin, we're only talking about 0.0025 milligrams of secretin, and it certainly is not in the bloodstream very long. So I think that you can begin to see what I'm talking about as far as dose. There are people that are using secretin sublingually as well in very small dilutions, about 1 to 600, and have been seeing some success with it. I'm really not prepared to comment on it myself because I don't have enough experience, but the comments I've heard have been favorable. As far as the mechanism of action of sublingual secretin, I really couldn't venture to know as to exactly how it works. Perhaps it sends a message to the brain.
I've heard that the cost of this therapy can be quite considerable, and presumably it's non-insurance reimbursable. Has this been a deterrent in its application and evaluation?
Yes, it can be fairly expensive, and that's because the drug itself is fairly expensive. With the emerging popularity of the therapy, I must say that I've seen that prices have seemed to skyrocket. However, it's been so successful that people seem to be willing to bear the expense to get their children treated.
What percentage of the children you've seen do you feel have been good responders to secretin?
I would say about 70%.
And does it seem to require repeated administration to maintain higher level function?
In some children, I have had to repeat administration of the secretin. The effect in some children, once again, seems to taper off after 3 to 6 weeks. And repeated dosage has restored the effect in a number of children. However, that has not been universal.
Given the mechanism that you were proposing, that it may relate to gut function and the ecology of flora in the gut and the interrelationship of that to the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue and how that interrelates then with blood-brain barrier communication messages to the brain, is the secretin administered with some kind of a program then that's directed towards the gut function as well as the neurotransmitter?
I feel that the frequency of dosage of secretin is probably going to end up being the most significant issue here. As I said before, I believe that it's healing the gut, and it would seem to me that repetitive doses would probably predispose to that happening. I would hope in the long term that the immune system would reach a point where it wouldn't need the boost that it's getting. and treatment could be stopped at that point.
Yes, I know that part of Dr. Baker and Rimland's DAN protocol is to look at ways of doing reflorestation of the gut, improving the floral ecology by what we've called historically as an acronym, the 4R approach, remove, replace, reinoculate, repair, so that one lowers some of the burden that possibly the dysbiotic organisms are having upon the immune system while also healing the gut using the secretin. It seems like there may be an integrated approach that is emerging using a very powerful therapeutic modulator along with a underlying normalizing dietary and lifestyle approach.
Well, Jeff, you know, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. And I'd like to add something. About 3 to 4 years ago, when I first became involved with autistic children, I was already treating adults with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. And I began to see a pattern of immune dysfunction in those patients. For some reason at that time, I felt that I might see the same thing in the autistic children. And in fact, I believe that the immune dysfunction in the autistic children is really the same process as what we see in adults, but the symptomatology just differs based on the maturity of the nervous system. So when I discuss this in terms of autism, I really feel that we're just hitting the tip of the iceberg and that there's a great deal of chronic illness in the country that has the same cause. To me, that's a very fascinating thing.
I really appreciate that insight because I think we're all looking for those Occam's razors, those interconnected understandings. David Dawkins talks about it in his book, The Fabric of Reality, in which he's talking about that emerging from our understanding of the evolution of medical science are central principles of disease, which may allow us to predict the success of therapies before they're even administered. And that's different than kind of the medical taxonomy approach that most of us learned in our schooling, which is each individual disease kind of stands unto itself. If you were to review this experience that you've had with secretin and autism and were to kind of communicate to individuals who have not crossed that bridge yet in their clinical practice and they feel more bound by their traditions through the double-blind placebo-controlled trial, would there be some kind of insight that you might provide for them as to the observations you've made and how one goes about as a responsible practitioner making decisions as it relates to therapies?
Well, Jeff, I have to tell you that the secretin experience for me and working with autistic children in general has been the most exciting thing I've ever done in medicine. It has rejuvenated my interest in medicine, and today I'm happy to say that I love what I'm doing. And I can't say that I've always been able to say that. I think that one just needs to be open-minded. Their heart has to be in the right place. They have to want to help people. I believe that today I'm using more of the basic science that I learned in medical school than I've ever used. You know, I always loved the basic sciences, Jeff. That's another wonderful feeling about pursuing this type of medicine. It's really been perhaps one of the most fulfilling things that's ever happened to me.
Well, that's a very exciting affirmation of the process and what I think medicine is all about, using knowledge and one's brain to put together programs that will help patients. And I really appreciate sharing that insight. We've been speaking to Dr. Jeffrey Koppelson, a medical doctor who has been working with secretin and its relationship to autism. And Dr. Koppelson, if people want to follow up with you, is there a place that they can write or call to learn a little bit more about your experience?
Yes. My phone number here at the office is 914-278-6800, and my fax is 914-278-6897, and I'd be happy to speak with almost anybody that would call.
On behalf of myself and all my colleagues here in functional medicine, we want to thank you for your dedication in sharing this information with us.
Thanks for the privilege, Jeff.
I want to thank once again Dr. Koppelson for this extraordinary application of the more esoteric principles that I was describing on side one of this tape, which was related to intracellular communication and its relationship to the web of dysfunction that later appears as disease. And I think he's really given the meat to the bone, so to speak, of this understanding. On side one, I was talking about oxidative stress. Dr. Orville Levander and his colleagues at the USDA Beltsville, Maryland Research Center have been looking at oxidative stress and the potentiation of viral infection, particularly looking at various types of infection like Coxsackie virus and its interrelationship with selenium status. As many of you know, if you heard the name Orville Evander, because he's been described in Functional Medicine Update for more than 12 years in his research, he did some of the early pioneering work on lead and its relationship to oxidative stress and how vitamin E helps to protect against lead impairment. More recently, he's been looking at selenium. Oxidative stress is implicated in the pathogenesis of several viral infections, including hepatitis, influenza, and even AIDS. Dietary oxidative stress due to either selenium or vitamin E deficiency increases cardiac damage in animals that have been affected with a myocarditic strain of Coxsackie virus. Such dietarily related oxidative stress that's concomitant with a viral infection allows a normally benign Coxsackie virus to convert to its virulent form and therefore cause heart damage, meaning low antioxidant status of vitamin E and selenium increases the mutational rate of a virus when it infects an individual and produces a more virulent strain. Very powerful, isn't it, when you start thinking of that interrelationship between genes, environment, and function. The conversion to virulence is due to a nucleotide sequence change in the genome of the benign virus, which then resembles more closely the nucleotide sequence of virulent strains. Although it has been known for many years that poor nutrition can affect host response to infection, the Levander work is actually the first report of how host nutrition affects the genetic sequence of a pathogen and modifies the expression of the organism in a more pathogenic form. What this would indicate, obviously, is that we need to be very concerned about nutritional status and maintenance of redox potential for the prevention and defense against chronic viral infections and how that may influence then the residence of a virus within our system for some period of time that, if not properly defended against, can result in mutational injury and more active virulence. By the way, if you want to read more about this, I suggest you read an excellent review on the Dr. Levander work in the Annual Reviews of Nutrition, Volume 18, page 93, in 1998. We know that antioxidants play a role in the protection against vascular disease, and the mechanism by which that occurs is still being studied. One of the suggestions is that antioxidants help protect against the conversion of monocytes and macrophages in the endothelial space into foam cells, and that relationship then to the oxidation of LDL into oxidized LDL, which then initiates monoclonal hyperplasia of the artery and produces the atheroma. And so antioxidants help defend against one of the angiotoxic injuries that may initiate atherosclerosis. There may, however, be other mechanisms by which antioxidants play a role in modifying the expression or the appearance of vascular disease. I was intrigued when I saw a recent paper in the Journal of Pediatrics, Volume 133, page 35 in 1998, where they talked about endothelial dysfunction occurring in children who have genetically related hyperlipidemias, that when they gave them antioxidant therapy, which was using, in this clinical trial, ascorbic acid, 500 milligrams twice a day, so 1,000 milligrams, and vitamin E, 400 IUs twice a day, so that's 800 IUs of vitamin E, and these are children from 6 to 18 years of age, so I wouldn't call an 18-year-old a child, but let's call it 6 to 18-year-old individuals, 18 who had familial hypercholesterolemia, and 15 with combined hyperlipoproteinemia, and 12 control subjects, and then they studied them with high-resolution two-dimensional ultrasonography. And when they looked at these particular individuals who had gotten the antioxidant therapy, who had these gene uniquenesses with hyperlipidemias, they found that there was a significant improvement in vascular reactivity during the supplementation period. They go on to say the improvement in vascular activity observed during supplementation with antioxidant vitamins suggests that reactive oxygen species derived from oxidized lipoproteins may be responsible for the impairment of vasoregulation in subjects with hyperlipidemia, which seems to confirm the preliminary evidence that Steinberg and others have come to, that oxidized LDL may be atherogenic and that if you can prevent the oxidation of LDL, that you can help defend against these conditions. And individuals with specific genotypes, these that are susceptible to hyperlipoproteinemias, may be more than responsive to these types of antioxidant therapy. So it's not just one size fits all. Again, personalized medicine. And the doses that were used in these children were 500 milligrams twice a day of ascorbic acid, 400 IUs of vitamin E twice a day. Again, not a dose maximized study, but just using a level that was far greater than the RDA to study the effects of antioxidant supplementation on vascular function and lipoprotein oxidation. Well, we also know that vitamin E does something other than just block the oxidation of LDL. It also has an influence on immune function and reduction of the expression of the pro-inflammatory cytokines like interleukin-6, interleukin-2, and tumor necrosis factor alpha, and their interrelationship to cortisol release from the adrenal glands, and how that interrelates then to the shift of cellular redox towards an oxidation potential. I'm now quoting from an interesting study done in animals, actually in pigs, that were exposed to endotoxin to upregulate their immune system so that they then expressed more of the pro-inflammatory cytokines, and how that then related to lipoprotein oxidation and vitamin E protection against it. This is Journal of Nutrition, Volume 128, page 1657 in 1998, in which the investigators showed that vitamin E supplementation in these animals was able to help resist the oxidative stress that occurred from exposure to lipopolysaccharides and the influence that had then on cardiovascular risk factors. So here is an inflammatory component that relates to cardiovascular risk factors, which goes beyond that just of the oxidation of LDL, an inflammatory component. And that might help us to understand other mechanisms by which vitamin E and other antioxidants participate in the protection against vascular disease. This was actually reviewed nicely in a recent paper in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 128, page 1593 in 1998, entitled Vitamin E and Atherosclerosis, in which Dr. Alvin Chan, Department of Biochemistry from Faculty of Medicine, University of Ottawa, talked about the fact that the protection against formation of foam cells could not only be due to the prevention of LDL oxidation, but also due to immunological normalization of function that then did not trigger these oxidative stress reactions. Well, that leads to the question, where does the inflammatory burst come from? What is the trigger that might upregulate the immunological system and express from the genes these pro-inflammatory cytokines like TNF-alpha and IL-2? A very interesting review in the journal Science and Medicine talks about this. This is their December 1998 issue, page 16, entitled Chronic Infection and Coronary Artery Disease, in which they go back to re-explore the Virchow hypothesis. Rudolf Virchow, the German physiologist who in the late portion of the 19th century proposed that vascular disease or coronary atherosclerosis was caused by infection and inflammation, and not the cholesterol hypothesis that was later advanced by Anechikow, the Russian physiologist at the turn of the century. Now it seems that there is something to the Virchow hypothesis, that chronic infection and inflammation through chlamydia pneumoniae or through Helicobacter pylori chronic infections may in fact tie themselves together in certain genotypes with the relative risk to atherosclerosis. This is a very compelling paper that gives some beautiful pathological and histological specimen examples of how infection may in fact have resulted in atherosclerosis, not just bacterial infection, but also viral infections like cytomegalovirus. You can track this chronic inflammation with markers in the plasma like C-reactive protein, and that tracks very closely, as you know, with the risk to cardiovascular disease. It's a cholesterol-independent risk factor to vascular disease, just as is high homocysteine levels, elevated homocysteine, a cholesterol-independent risk factor to vascular disease. In a recent issue of Clinical Laboratory Review, Volume 24, page 14 in 1998, there was a nice review of the clinical utility of C-reactive protein for evaluating the relative risk to cardiovascular disease as a cholesterol-independent risk factor when it's elevated, again showing chronic inflammatory potential and increased oxidative stress and gene expression modulation towards this redox potential that we described earlier, NF-kappa-B upregulation, for instance. Interestingly enough, individuals with severe atherosclerosis are found often to have a defective mannose-binding lectin site on the gastrointestinal mucosa, which may then increase their relative risk to inflammatory responses to their environment and to infectious organisms like chlamydia pneumoniae. You notice what I just said. I just connected the gut, didn't I, to the heart. Web-like thinking. By the way, those of you not familiar with this paper, you might want to look at it. The Lancet, Volume 352, page 959 in 1998, Association of mannose-binding lectin deficiency with severe atherosclerosis. Remember we had Dr. Peter Diadamo, not too long ago as a clinician of the month talking about the Eat for a Year type diet, using the ABO blood group as a way of evaluating how a person would react to certain dietary principles like lectins, and how that would influence the inflammatory system through the GALT, the gut-associated mucosal tissue. He was an August 1997 clinician of the month on his concepts. Dr. Diadamo's presumptions and suggestions seem to be more and more borne out with more research. Chlamydia pneumoniae carries the relevant structure for binding of certain histocompatibility locus antigens that are shown to prevent pneumoniae from gaining access to cells, even in the presence of complements. Therefore, it's possible that mannose-binding lectin protein, which sits on the surface of gastrointestinal mucosal cells, probably participates in the first-line defense against chlamydia species. And if an individual has a defective binding, that they may be more susceptible to infection, which then increases the likelihood of upregulation of their immune system, which sets in motion the oxidative stress, increased production of C-reactive protein and TNF-alpha, and increased vascular injury and stickiness of white cells to the vascular endothelium, transmigration, conversion of foam cells, and so forth. So what we're saying is the gut is connected to the vasculature, which is connected to the heart and coronary arteries. A pretty remarkable association as we start looking at these webs. The authors of this paper go on to say that if confirmed in prospectively designed studies, the results of their study may provide a genetic explanation of why only a few chlamydia pneumoniae infections result in ischemic heart disease. Our observation would, however, reflect an association with other pathogens or some unsuspected non-infective mechanism, i.e. gut dysbiosis and toxicity, related to the development of atherosclerosis. Very, very interesting, to say the least. So one might look at some of these stories from a different perspective when you start examining how binding sites and intercellular communication and gene expression all interrelate. That leads us, obviously, to talking about some of the newly discovered molecules that are involved in setting up these intercellular signals, the so-called STATs and JAKs. STATs are the signal transducers and activators of transcription, STATSs, signal transducers and activators of transcription. And the JAKs, J-A-K-S, stands for the Janus family of tyrosine kinases. They interrelate to upregulate the expression in the genes of the NF-kappa B and interferon gamma and the type 2 pro-inflammatory cytokines like TNF-alpha, tumor necrosis factor alpha. They then upset the balance between the type 1 cytokines and the type 2 cytokines, which then shifts the body into a pro-inflammatory state. And these STATs, these molecules called collectively as the signal transduction activators of transcription, are in part released by activation of the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue, as well as systemic immunological components. So, again, the gut is connected to the Kupffer cells of the liver, which is connected to the white blood cells of the vasculature, which is coupled to the glial cells of the brain. These are all embryogenically derived from the similar embryonic cells and can ultimately then be seen as having similar responses to the environment and upregulation of the immune system. I was very excited, as I'm sure you were, to see that these concepts of second signal messengers and interrelationship to signal transduction and how these mediators play a role in chronic illness and function was the object of the Nobel Prize in Medicine for 1998. Dr. Furchtgott, Ignaro, and Dr. Farhad Murad were the recipients of the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1998 for the discovery of nitric oxide and how it regulates blood vessels and it serves as a neurotransmitter and how it goes on to play an extraordinary role in a myriad of functions related to the immunological system. I think we at Functional Medicine take extraordinary pride in this discovery and in the receipt of the Nobel Prize to Dr. Murad in that he was a presenter at our fourth International Symposium on Functional Medicine in Aspen, Colorado, talking about his discoveries of nitric oxide. Now, I want to add parenthetically that there were many people who attended that fourth International Symposium who thought his talk was too basic science, too esoteric, and too removed from clinical practice. In retrospect, however, I think it can be seen that although, yes, it was heavy-going science, the understanding of the implications of nitric oxide and its influence on how we will look at webs of disorders to come up with new therapies was an extraordinarily important part of a path of discovery and education for the students of functional medicine. And I think we all have to push ourselves at times to our places of less comfort with our knowledge and open our minds to the thoughts that maybe through these discoveries will come extraordinary opportunities for growth, even though the first time it may be a little painful. And I think Dr. Murad's presentation, which was very elegant science, may have pushed people's scientific fluency, but in retrospect, infected all of us with a thought of where the future of this field might take us and new ways of looking at modulation of function. And recall, nitric oxide is an important molecule because it's a very important molecule for proper vascular tone and proper neurotransmission and proper immunological defense. It has three forms, derived from three isoforms of nitric oxide synthase, an immune-inducible form, a constitutive endothelial and neuronal form. So it plays polyorgan effects in function. And therefore, the symptoms of nitric oxide misregulation can be seen in myriad of different organs and different symptoms. And what we learn is that balance is important. It's not that nitric oxide is a bad molecule. It's a very important molecule, just as are the prostaglandins. But it's balance that's important. And too little is not good. Too much is not good. Balance of nitric oxide in various tissues. And that leads us, of course, to the agents that cause alteration in nitric oxide, like sildenafil, which, as you know, Viagra, has received a tremendous amount of attention as a drug that modulates nitric oxide production, purportedly just in the penis, causing increased vasodilation and increased vascular perfusion of the penis and improved erection. However, because nitric oxide is not specific, nor is that enzyme nitric oxide synthase and its relationship to cyclic GMP, which relates to nitric oxide synthase activation, is not found just in the reproductive organs of males, we start to see adverse side effects appearing, or let's call it side effects appearing elsewhere in the body, like blue vision in some individuals and headaches in other individuals. And most recently, reports in the Lancet, volume 352, page 957 in 1998, of possible risk to acute myocardial infarction in individuals who are not on nitrate-containing drugs, who took Viagra, who the outcome appeared to be death itself. So genetic specificity, personalized medicine, one size doesn't fit all. Again, knowing that if we start tampering with the web, that we get very significant effects on lots of different influences within function. In some individuals, it may not be desirable, so we have to look at the effects, not just make assumptions. Obviously, the way that this web is modified is through things that we do every day, like the way we eat and how we think and how we behave. For instance, individuals that don't get enough B12 folate and B6 in their diets are individuals who have different gene expression and modulation. In fact, elevated expression and altered patterns of the activity of DNA methyltransferase were seen in livers of animals that were fed B6, B12, and folate insufficient diets. This is Carcinogenesis, volume 19, page 1777. We know that eating things like soy that contains isoflavones, genistein, and diazine will modify the risk to diseases and do so by modifying signal transduction and intercellular communication, because these are isoflavones that influence kinase enzymes, protein tyrosine kinase, as expressed in the Journal of Nutrition, volume 128, page 1589 in 1998. And we know that humans that consume soybeans with isoflavones have increased plasma, urine, and fecal levels of these agents, and that some difference in absorption can occur from one person to another based upon their digestion, assimilation, and tissue distribution. So the same amount of soy in our diet may be different in its effects from individual to individual on their digestion, absorption, and tissue response at the receptor site levels of these signal modulators like the soy isoflavones. Again, I'm quoting Journal of Nutrition, volume 128, page 1710 in 1998. And we know that there are many other nutritive agents that influence intracellular communication, like lycopene, the red pigment found in tomatoes, which is better absorbed from tomato paste than fresh tomatoes, and better absorbed when given along with the olive oil, i.e. the Italian diet, which then influences various aspects of cellular differentiation and expression in the prostate in males, and may therefore be the cause of the reduced prostate cancer seen in individuals who consume a lot of pizza and tomato sauce. This is American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 66, page 116 in 1997. We know that broccoli and broccoli sprouts and members of the cruciferous vegetable family contain glucosinolates that upregulate the expression of various detox enzymes that influence the intracellular activity and the mediators that help to set balance of the internal and external environment. The work of Paul Talalay at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine on broccoli sprouts as inducers of enzymes to protect against chemical carcinogens. This is in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Volume 94, page 10367 in 1997. And what about the extraordinary work that's ongoing now with green tea and its constituent epigallocatechin, gallate, which is a very powerful gene response modulator and antioxidant and redox potential agent. Again, numerous papers on its protective effect. And even the Journal of the National Cancer Institute now has a recent article entitled Tea Therapy, Out of the Cup, Into the Lab, in which people are studying now very extensively epigallocatechin gallate and its potential in chemo prevention. So we are seeing and witnessing the emergence of a new paradigm in health that is web-like rather than linear and reductionistic, that uses the environment as a tool rather than as a hazard, and starts to construct a personalized medicine, which will be the future and focus of Functional Medicine Update as we move through 1999. Thanks for the first of our issue. We'll look forward to being with you the rest of the year.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by HealthCom International Incorporated of Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.